Murray made this point in the Time Most Influential People of 2006 piece about you, where he said, he mentioned that you in fact had been studying things like relationships that you've been talking about, such formulae, remarkably precise, holding true from shrews to whales. Does it apply to social organizations such as cities and companies? Then he says, think those things don't affect you directly. Yeah. Think again. Studies of social animals, for instance, can teach us a lot about how armies and terrorist groups work, allowing us to respond better to security threats. Knowing how our brains learn can help us design better computers, and so on and so forth. So let's take up this point that he made. You have a paper, Growth, Innovation, Scaling, and the Pace of Life in Cities.
Yeah.
What's that about?
Yeah. So, as I mentioned earlier, the work originally started attacking these questions in biology, trying to understand, first of all, scaling in biology. And I should have actually said this at the time. Understanding scaling is actually just the veneer of this, because scaling is seen in this as a window onto underlying principles and dynamics. And that's the way I think most physicists think about it. It is a manifestation of something that is much more fundamental going on. And we proposed, as I said earlier, that what is going on here is actually fundamental generic properties of networks. That's what's going on, and that is manifesting itself in these scaling laws and is in fact determining a large part of the physiology and life history of typical organisms of a given size. It was natural, given that, and given what we thought of as the great success of that work, because it had a huge number of predictions, explained an enormous amount of data, was to take that into other kinds of analogous systems. And the obvious ones are social organizations to begin with, corporations and cities. And in fact, you could put this in terms of a kind of whimsical question, and ask the question, you live in San Diego, is San Diego just a great big organism? After all, it obviously derived from biology, human beings. Maybe it's just a great big organism, just a huge whale in some sense. Or is it that when human beings started talking to one another, doing what we're doing now, forming communities, acting in a more coherent way together, and was it that a completely new dynamic evolved that is outside of what we traditionally think of biology, so that even though biology has been on this planet for more than a billion years, this dynamic has actually only been around for 5,000 years. Mm-hmm. That then, just now talking in these very big terms, brings up the question, if we can understand that, maybe we could learn something about the underlying science of long-term sustainability.
Right.
We know that life is extraordinarily robust and sustainable. It's been around for several billion years. But it may be that social life that we think of, and that is this, having all the stuff that is our life, is actually just a blip. It was an experiment that may last 5 to 10,000 years, and that's it. But maybe there's a way of understanding that. Anyway. So it was very natural to take these ideas and ask questions about social organizations. So if we go back to the biology, so one of the things that you discover from these scaling laws is that instead of thinking of, the whale as being unique because it swims in the ocean, and the giraffe is unique because it has a long neck, and the elephant has a long trunk, and we stand on two legs, and the shrew can walk around on my palm of my hand, these are all kind of unique features, then in fact, to a large degree, there's only one mammal. There's only one mammal, and all mammals are simply a scaled version of that one mammal. There's only one. And just in the same way that we think there's kind of an idealized human being, And the 6 billion of us on this planet are actually just small variants of this one. You know, we have some obvious differences between us, you and me. Obviously, we can tell the difference. Some of us have different color skins and some of us are short and tall. Nevertheless, we all believe, I think all of us believe, even the most prejudiced of people now believe, that actually we're all variants of human beingness. Okay? As you well know, that was once disputed. I mean, it was once thought that people with black skins were not human. You know? But now everybody believes this. So in the same way, this says, this expands that. This says there's only one mammal and we're all variants of it. Your cat and your dog and your whale and your gorilla, we're all just variants of it. And what you see is totally superficial in the same way that, you know, colored skin or great height are actually quite superficial phenomena. Okay, question is that true of cities? Is San Diego a scaled down New York City and a scaled up Santa Fe? That's a question you can answer. Look different, look completely different. They're in very different climates. They seem to function somewhat differently. They seem to play different roles and so on. Nevertheless, it's a question you can ask and a question you can answer because you do what we talked about earlier for biology. You look at all the various characteristics you can think of that describe a city, from things like average wages, number of hospitals, number of police, amount of crime, length of roadways, whatever you can think of. And you ask, how does that scale with city size? Now, if each city is sort of unique, totally unique, it evolved in its own unique way because San Diego was on the ocean and it had a port and the Navy went there and made a big deal out of it and it is very close to the border with Mexico. Here, we're up in the high desert. We build things out of adobe. You know, there's not much rain and so on. It's totally very different to San Diego. You would expect when you plot any of these, you'd be just all over the bloody place in terms of these points. Well, I wouldn't be talking to you about this if we didn't discover, and it's amazing that no one had looked at this, that if you look at any of these metrics, they all line up with some obvious fluctuations on nice scaling curves. And that indeed, to a good approximation, cities of a given urban system, meaning, say, all American cities, are, to a reasonable approximation, just scaled versions of one another. And that there is, in some sense, one city. And if you tell me, you know, the length of roadways in that city, I can tell you how much surface area of roads there are in New York.
All right. So this is not just at the sort of popular magazine, which is the nicest city to live in kind of level. This is in terms of we are this planet that we have put our thumbprint, fingerprint, footprint all over, and now have to be considering how to manage its future. These are the kind of numbers, statistics, and terraforming data that we need to be able to plan more effectively into the future. So it's a,
Yes, absolutely. So let me go back to your question a moment ago. What use is this? So let me just tell you a couple of things about cities that really, when I started working on this, I actually wanted to work on corporations. It was the social organization that I was wanted to work on. But it was very hard to get data. It's very proprietary and so on. And we turned to cities, and I was kind of disappointed at the beginning because I didn't think that was so interesting. As soon as I got into it, I found it absolutely compelling, and I'm quite passionate about it. And part of it is just the science, but part of it is because of your question, what use is it? And here's what got me, was when I realized, and many people are very familiar with this, much more so than I, you know, about in the last year or two, let's begin at the beginning. 200 years ago, the United States, and in fact the planet as a whole, roughly speaking, only 3% or so of people were urbanized. The vast majority were agricultural in one form or another. Now, in the United States, it's over 80% urbanized. In the planet as a whole, a year or two ago, we passed the halfway mark. We have just moved from being having cities being in the minority to city number of people, that is, living in cities, being in the majority, just past the 50% mark. That number is predicted to go to a order of 60% in 2030, and most dramatically to 80% in 2050. The planet basically is being urbanized, and most importantly is to recognize that all of the problems that we feel, this tsunami of social problems hitting us, from global warming to questions of the environment, to financial markets, risk, to crime, pollution, disease, are all urban. They're predominantly urban problems, and that's why is it? Why is it that we've known of these problems? I've known of pollution, and I've known of global warming for 20 or more years. Each one of these problems that I mentioned, we've known about them. But in the last few years, suddenly they seem to be all over us. And there's serious questions of sustainability. Why? Because the planet has urbanized at a faster than exponential rate. So in the last 10 years, 20 years, something that 20 years ago was certainly problems, but except for a very small, tiny minority, were not considered serious problems, are now more and more being perceived, even by world leaders, as serious, threatening problems, not just to a nation, but to the planet. And they all come from cities. Furthermore, so cities are the source of our problem, but they're also, of course, the source of our solution, because cities where all the smart people are. Cities are hubs of innovation, creativity, wealth creation. They are also magnets or vacuum cleaners for smart people. They suck them up. One of the exercises I wanted to get a student to do is to take a who's who and look, you know, which, okay, represents famous people. These are where it's at. These are the people that make things happen. Look at where they live. They would predominantly be in cities: New York, San Francisco, Paris, London, Bombay, Sydney. Look at where they're born. I bet you it's completely differently distributed. They're born in small towns and they have been sucked into these urban centers. So cities are the source of our problems, are the source of our solutions. And the bottom line to this is that from a physicist viewpoint, from the viewpoint I've expressed in terms of the biology, that is, in terms of having something that is quantitative and predictive, we do not have a theory of cities. We don't have a theory of growth, organization, structure, and evolution of cities. And maybe there isn't one, but that's what this work is now focused on. Now, there are theories of cities, but they're almost entirely qualitative. They're not quantitative and predictive.
Qualitative in the sense of, I'm thinking now that one of the people who used to write about cities a great deal was Lewis Mumford.
Yeah, Lewis Mumford was wonderful, wonderful writing.
Maybe 50 years ago.
Yeah, fantastic. And he saw a lot of these problems, incidentally. In fact, there are a few people that saw these problems.
Jane Jacobs.
And Lewis Mumford being two of the major ones. And they in no way created what a physicist would think of as a theory of city, meaning that you could predict what the growth of a particular city is, what its trajectory will be, what urbanization will happen to the planet, and so on.
Well, but look, so you're saying that if people had a statistical or a framework for analyzing these things, then they might actually pay more attention to alarm bells when other
they
people
might,
sound.
And it may be that such a theory could form a basis for a theory of sustainability of the planet.
But how hard is it? Look how hard it is to get any agreement at all on something global warming.
Absolutely, and I must
say... Which cities are implicitly connected, since they are large meteorological objects in themselves.
I must say, I'm not very optimistic about the future of cities or the future of the kinds of social life most of us have come to take for granted long-term on the planet, if we're thinking 50, 100, 500 years. And one of the things that led me to that is that out of this work came, without understanding in a deep way, frankly, the underlying network dynamics of cities. One of the things that did come out of it was an understanding, despite not having a detailed theory, why it is that the pace of life in cities gets faster and faster the bigger the city grows. Why it is that as you evolve in time, the speed at which things like disease spread, the speed at which people walk, the speed at which bank transactions take place, amazingly go faster and faster in a systematic way that is actually in agreement with this rather still yet to be developed complete theory. Nevertheless, that's one thing that comes out of it. And the other thing that comes out of it is to understand why it is that you have to innovate. You have to go through major innovation. That's why innovation is in the title of that paper that you referred to. Why it is you have to have a major innovation. What do I mean by major innovation? I mean something like, you know, the discovery of iron, the discovery of coal, the invention of computer, the discovery of steam, some major innovation that completely changes the culture and the way in which society is now structured, IT being the latest. I mean, computers were one, but IT actually was something different when we realized that that goes somehow beyond, you know, cyberspace is something that is a powerful actor now, of course, in our culture. But you have to do these at an accelerating rate. So that going back to the ideas that we discussed earlier in biology, one of the things I didn't emphasize is that one of the things that comes out of this that work was that as you get bigger, the pace of life slows in a systematic way, according to these quarter powers. So that the rate at which oxygen diffuses across your lungs takes longer the bigger you are. Your heart rate gets slower. You live longer in a very systematic way. So you get this image of a ponderous elephant and a skittish mouse. Yeah. You know, and that can be put into a very simple mathematical framework, and it is driven by these the properties of these networks in biology. But life, the pace of life gets slower. It turns out social networks, as manifested in cities and in these scaling laws, gives rise to the exact opposite phenomenon. And I can say a few words about that in a moment, but that exact opposite phenomenon is that the pace of life speeds up the bigger you are in a systematic way. And as I say, the data is in pretty good agreement with that. And this is to do with, going back to my original question, are social organizations just great big organisms, biological organisms, or did something different develop? And the answer is yes, something different did develop. And it is associated with innovation on a short time scales and wealth production. And that is represented in these scaling laws, that if you look at metrics which are uniquely social, that is, they don't have a simple analog in biology, and are associated with creative behavior, such as number of patents produced, number of schools, number of colleges, even wages themselves, amount of crime, that's very creative, and so on. If you look at all those, you find that they scale in a way that you never see in biology. And that is represented by an exponent, which is bigger than one, what we call superlinear scaling. And here's what it means. Let me go back to biology. Metabolic rate scales as mass to the three quarters. What does that mean? That means the metabolic rate per unit mass decreases with size as mass to the one quarter. That is, the bigger you are, the less energy per unit time is required to support a unit mass, say a gram of tissue, same tissue. So there's kind of an economy of scale. The bigger you are, the less you need per gram to support it. That's an extraordinary systematic economy of scale. If you go to the social aspects of social organizations, patents, wages, crime, and so on, what you find is this superlinear behavior, an exponent bigger than one, also a universal number, which turns out to be about 1.2, which says that the bigger the city, the more wages there are per capita, the more fancy restaurants there are per capita, the more creative people there are per capita, the more colleges there are per capita, the more crime there is per capita, the more police there are per capita, the more taxes you pay per capita, all to the same degree, as if they're all somehow intertwined. So there is an increase rather than a decrease per capita. And this has extraordinary consequences in terms of leading to an increase in the pace of life.
But wouldn't you have expected this? I mean, you shove in more people, then intuitively, wouldn't you expect there to be more of everything? And
yes, you would, but that's not true in biology. It's not true in biology. Turns out the more you have, you get an economy of scale. You get actually less. And that's, it's much more efficient to be big.
Whereas if you have those tiny little dogs that are no bigger than a hand muff, they tend to die early.
They die much, much before you do.
Yeah.
So so the point is to have a serious theory where you could predict all of this. You could calculate. You know, in biology, we claim we can calculate those three quarters and one quarters and all the rest and understand the details of the network. We have not yet found a theoretical structure that actually calculates this magic number of 1.2. That is that the, you know, it's as if that if you go to New York to get a higher wage, you will be guaranteed on the average, for the average person, to get a 15 to 20% greater increase in salary. You will also have 15 to 20% more colleges, more restaurants, 15 to 20% more restaurants, 15 to 20% more creative people around, 15 to 20% more crime, 15% more pollution, and 15 to 20% more disease. But always that same amount, roughly. Not 80% more crime. Not, on the average, 75% more fancy restaurants. It's very consistent. And the question is, why is that? Why do all these things sort of cluster around the same increase, the same greater, what's called, greater return to scale?
Any ideas?
We believe it's the underlying network structure, but that's very much work in progress.
So you mentioned 2050, things that are going to be happening by 2050. This is still in the cities, in a sense, because a lot of more people are going to cities. The Economist, in its issue of the June 27th, just very recently, had a huge special report on aging populations called A Slow-Burning Future.
Yes, indeed.
And the numbers, the statistics that have come here from the UN are really sort of alarming. But between the period between now and 2050, populations are aging rapidly.
So we have a double whammy. We have a double whammy.
Number of births are going down.
We have a double whammy here. That is that people are moving to cities. At the same time, a phenomenon has occurred in the last 50 years, which is completely new, and probably has occurred in our lifetime. That is, I certainly grew up with the image that in my lifetime, roughly speaking, even though things would change, the essential paradigms of life were going to be the same. Meaning, going back to what I was saying, these major innovations, most people lived their productive lifespan, which was typically only of the order of 20 years, productive lifespan, because they, well, maybe 30 years. So they started work at 15, and they were dead at 45, so maybe 30 years. When with the same paradigm, you know, there was coal or, you know, the people that were on the cusp of these, but you had this idea that things were pretty much the same. This has now changed. The time between these major innovations is now maybe 20 years most, and the productive lifespan, because of the increase in longevity, is 50 years maybe. So this is an incredible sociological, psychological problem, and is now becoming a serious economic problem, because for the differences between developed and developing countries, because another phenomenon that occurs with increase of social metabolic rate, as distinct from biological metabolic rate, is that fecundity, that is fertility, it's not fertility, fecundity, that is number of offspring, goes down. And that has decreased rapidly in the Western world and has remained, you know, and is decreasing, but has remained quite high in underdeveloped countries. So we have incredible pressures on the cities in developing countries. And one of the specters that we face is the difficulty of maintaining cities in developing countries, and at the same time in developed countries, but in developing countries, the specter of cities of slums. And, you know, it's hard not to get very pessimistic about this and simply see the planet as devolving to a planet of slums.
One of the sections in this Economist report is A World of Methuselahs, is the title of it. The benefits and costs of living longer. And there are various speculations here about how lifespan could be extended. Why are people living longer beyond the obvious, which is better medical care and so on and so forth. These are the sorts of things that are going to come up, I suspect, in the workshop that you'll be running.
Yes, some will. Yeah, no question.
Which is called The Physical Foundations and Systems Biology of Aging. So I wonder if we could get a bit of a sense of this. I mean, you mentioned before that, you know, a mouse runs to lives maybe 2 years. I see that one of the participants here actually got the Methuselah, Andrei Bartke, got the Methuselah Mouse Prize for extending a mouse lifespan to 5 years or something like that. There's obviously these enormously controversial issues about the topic of negligible senescence and the notion of strategies for engineered senescence. There's Ray Kurzweil talking about reaching some sort of point at which, you know, aging essentially ceases and one lives forever and so on and so forth. So between these extremes of your pessimistic slums and living forever on some bright, shiny future.
Right. Yeah, we're on.
How do we get a grip
on
this?
So I don't know. So let me just say, let me go back to that city, the planet of slums, and this question of, you know, is the planet, well, the planet will be sustained, but and life will almost certainly continue. Question is, will we continue? Not we as human beings. Human beings will continue, but maybe we'll all become hunter-gatherers. Question is the kind of social life that we call life, will that continue? And as I said earlier, this is unquestionably something that I'm more and more becoming interested in, and I've wandered into it through this work. I mean, the work kind of led me there, and this is very much work in progress. And, you know, the specter of a planet of slums is, you know, it's not me as a scientist speaking directly. It's me as me looking at, you know, the kinds of work that we've been involved in and intuitively extrapolating, and it does not look good. Now, that's yet to be done. I mean, and one of the reasons I'm so passionate about it is that I do believe that we need to develop a serious theory of this, of social organization, cities in particular, and understand that. So just as an aside comment, you know, the other important kind of social organizations that determine a lot of our life are, in fact, corporations and businesses, because we are economic beings. And one of the fascinating observations, it seems to me, is that almost all cities survive. You know, we're all familiar with cities that have died, usually from some major catastrophe. But, you know, if you think of the hundreds of thousands of cities, almost all of them are still here. They're still here and they will go on being here. And that is in marked contrast to corporations and businesses. Almost no businesses survive. A business, you know, almost all of them are gone within 5 to 10 years. And they are outliers of ones that last 100 years or more. There are a few real outliers that have gone several hundred years in very special circumstances, but they are very tiny number on the scale of things. Almost all businesses are gone within 50 years and very few last 100 years. One major exception to all of this is the Vatican, which is a business that has lasted for 1,000 years, and that has very special properties. And it is a business in many ways. It's also a state. It also has many. So that's a fascinating question. What is the difference? Why is it that if we organize ourselves as cities, we seem to be socially sustainable, but if we run a business, what is going on that determines the lifespan of businesses should be tens of years only? Well, we ought to be able to answer those questions, and out of that theory ought to come statements about structures, dynamics, organization of cities, and this whole question of pace of life, pressures to innovate, and understanding, is this in fact a sustainable system? Or is it doomed to collapse? Does it lead inevitably to the singularities of life, which I haven't talked about, but is implicit in the work that explicit in the work in the papers, but the singularities that innovation drives, do these pile up so that you can no longer sustain it? So that's the kind of, this is still speculative. Now let's go to your question about aging and some really fascinating questions about questions of delaying senescence. As you say, the most extreme being that maybe we could morph into a situation where aging is no longer a phenomenon that we deal with. Well, I have a very conservative view, again, based only on the work that I've done, and it's unpublished, and it's work on trying to develop a theory of aging, which is quantitative, where you can understand why a number like 100 years, if you're a human being, does evolve from microscopic timescales. It's a very crude theory, and it is almost certainly incomplete. Nevertheless, again, and I'm now speculating from that, I view it as unlikely that we will be able to be the kinds of organisms we now are, that's a big caveat here, and extend lifespan in any serious way for anything but possibly a small number of people. And let me just elaborate on that. One of the things that is very persuasive in terms of us now as the kind of human beings that we are, that have evolved by natural selection and have now developed into social organisms, one of the things that's very interesting is to look at the progression of survival curves. And this is well known. That is, if you look at what people have speculated, really, about ancient societies, particular places like Rome, Athens, about survival curves, meaning what are the percentage of people that survive to such and such an age, and you draw that curve. And what you find is, of course, most people die, I mean, in traditional societies, before they're 50, and very, very few live beyond it. And what happens as you look from ancient times through modern, through medieval period to, you know, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, to modern times, where data gets better and better. I mean, one of the problems is getting, you know, believable data, but some people claim they have data that you ought to believe. But if you look at that, the general trend is that people have lived longer and longer on the average. No question. Mm-hmm. You know, our great-grandparents, well, it's mine, you know, were dying before they were 50. My grandparents maybe lived to 60, and my parents lived to just over 60, and I'm now going to be 69, and with luck, I'll live into my 70s and so on. And that's kind of typical. However, what is extraordinary is that even those curves have been shifting out and out, that is, more and more people are surviving to later and later age, the end point has stayed roughly invariant. Namely, no one has lived more than approximately 100, I get this number wrong to be precise, of approximately 125 years. Of course, that did happen fairly recently. There was this French lady that lived to that age. But, you know, the maximum lifespan has barely moved. And that's very suggestive that there are biological constraints, even in the best of conditions, that is, remaining who we are, that allow us to live much beyond that. So that's the first point, and one can develop a theory around that. Now, you can now ask, okay, what are the interventions that you might be able to do that extend that? And that's the question. Well, maybe you can. And one of the things that I do believe is possible, even with a conservative view, is that one of the presumably important components of lifespan, of longevity, is that at the group and individual level, is that you have very good repair mechanisms. Now, natural selection, presumably, allowed us to evolve so that in our, quote, natural state, meaning, you know, before we socialized, where we lived to, you know, 40, 45, you had 20 children, of which maybe half survived. You know, if you lived much beyond, a woman lived much beyond 40, wouldn't you? It was an accident, and natural selection, I'm anthropomorphizing it, didn't care, you know. We do care. We have found ways already of prolonging that lifespan. And as you already mentioned, disease, but I suspect the biggest determinant of that has been hygiene. The fact that we wash ourselves, that had an enormous effect in extending lifespan from, you know, 45 to 65 and so on. And, you know, medicine has helped in certain regards. So what else can we do beyond that? So what this suggests, now going back to that demographic statistics on these survival curves, what it suggests is that even if you had the best medicine in the world and you were, you know, extraordinarily careful and so on and so forth, as much intervention as possible, you ain't going to make it much beyond about 125 anyway. So what else can we do? Well, I mentioned these repair mechanisms. Maybe we can intervene with repair mechanisms. Namely, you know, what are those determined by? They're typically determined by some genetic phenomenon. Genes determine many things. They probably, my own view, which is probably controversial, they do not determine directly longevity. But they determine longevity through repair mechanisms. That is, the way your metabolic energy is apportioned to repair, and how that repair takes place. But you can manipulate that with genes. Genes can manipulate that, and they do. And that's one methodology. So you can increase repair. The other thing you could do is decrease damage, decrease wear and tear. And one way of doing that, which has already been demonstrated and you're referring to there, is, of course, eating less. Because the less you eat, the less you metabolize, and the less damage you do due to spin-offs from metabolism. Some of those are well known, like, you know, oxygen radicals, which are the chemical detritus from metabolism, which actually do damage. But there's all kinds of other damage that metabolism does, because there's flows through these networks. And these are what physicists and engineers call dissipative systems. They cause damage. They create entropy. In fact, the reason you eat is, in fact, to combat entropy production and dissipative forces. So one of the great kind of ironies of life is the very system that is keeping you alive is actually killing you. You know, I mean, the metabolic system is actually, which is sustaining you, is actually killing you at the same time. And can you change that in some ways? Well, as I said, you can do it by so-called caloric restriction, by decreasing the amount of metabolism and the flows in those systems, in those networks. And indeed, that's been amply demonstrated. And just an aside, the little theory that I've told you about that I developed, that you can determine in principle the lifespan and the scaling of lifespan, actually predicts quantitatively the increase in lifespan due to caloric restriction through decreasing the active metabolic rate. But this is a very subtle business, because you might also think, gee whiz, maybe I should become a couch potato, because that decreases my, you know, eat less and not move much, right? Because then I can use even less energy. Well, there almost certainly is some truth in that, actually. This is very politically incorrect, but there's some truth in that. The problem, of course, is that, and this illustrates the point I'm going to come to in a minute, is there are all kinds of unintended consequences. Because if you don't exercise at all, of course, many systems that need stimulus no longer are functional, and in fact it enhances mortality and aging. So there are these systems. So the point of this is all of these things are highly coupled systems, and interfering with one has unintended consequences on another. So, albeit great, let's reapportion energy. Eat less, caloric restriction, fiddle with the genes so you put more energy into repair. But you could imagine, just now, total speculation, that indeed you increase longevity from maximum lifespan from 125 to 199 years, but that last 74 years are spent literally on the couch because you can't move. You know, you don't have, other things have happened that you can't move, even though you might be able to keep the organism alive. So this requires much more extensive thinking, a much more systemic, integrated thinking that is very much the essence of thinking in terms of complex systems.
Because you can't just
because
do one thing.
That is the problem. I'm not allowed to use four-letter words in this, right? Probably.
Whatever,
so I better
you like.
Not. But thinking that you can twiddle a knob here and twiddle a knob there, and it doesn't actually, they don't interfere with each other, has really got us into the problems we have now as a society. And, you know, the classic being, you know, the subprime mortgage, which is a diddly part of the economy. Let's face it, it's a small part of the economy. But it is a complex system. It has chaos built into it. It has exponential sensitivity to boundary conditions. So you have to know that if you twist a knob here just by a small amount, and it's a small thing that you're twisting, you gotta know maybe that's the one that causes, you know, it's the butterfly effect, the tsunami over here. So you need to understand that. And fiddling around with aging has very much this characteristic, because it's to do with life history and the whole integrated complexity of an organism. So, whereas I am very enthusiastic, may I say, about people investigating this, so I don't want to be, but you need to have a, you need to really not do it with the blinders on. And my concern is that some of the work, in fact, I would say most of the work that I've seen along these lines has the blinders on.
So this is a very interesting trajectory, having got into all of these issues, some of it obviously stemming from being associated with the Institute
sure.
as well and
oh,
knowing
absolutely.
People. But how did you even get into science in the first place? I mean, were your parents scientists?
No. Yeah, that's a funny, it's a hard one to answer in some ways. But yes, I think fundamentally it was because I was good at mathematics. You know, I was good at mathematics. And certain things really grabbed me. The power of mathematics grabbed me. And when I learnt, you know, very early on that there were formulas for things that happened in the real world that, you know, I could derive at age, I don't know, whatever age it was, you know, 13, 14, that seemed to be correct. That just was mystical, actually. I must say, it was always, I hate to use the word, but spiritual, almost. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. So one of the ones that always sticks in my mind, and it may have been because we lived for quite a while on the south coast of England, in Hove, actually. So there's the cliffs, the White Cliffs. And so I was very conscious of the fact that ships go down over the horizon. They sink below the horizon.
Mm.
And there was a problem we did one day in trigonometry, which was to calculate how far the horizon was away. And in terms of, you know, where, and the input to that was the radius of the Earth. And I thought, this is astonishing that, you know, isn't that amazing that you could do that? And that really grabbed me as something like, and it was in marked contrast to a religious upbringing, which had all kinds of explanations for things, which at some level, I believed in a kind of naivete, and I found very beautiful, actually. But I suddenly realized that this, even though it was some trivial piece of the universe, was so powerful and so much more powerful than, I don't know, the kinds of explanations about the universe. This was kind of at an unconscious level, that this was very important. And one of the things that was a thread in my life because of that, that doesn't explain why I'm in science, but it, in some ways it does, it explains why I remained in science, is that also at about that age, I may have the dates wrong a little bit, was that there was, I remember reading an article about the steady state theory of the universe, the Hoyle and, what was the other one?
Wickramasinghe.
No. Anyway, Hoyle was the article was about Hoyle because he was, kind of a popular character. But it was about the steady state universe. That, you know, the universe was in steady state. And then I read that, and then Hoyle made this sarcastic comment about, in contrast, steady state to the Big Bang, as something silly, you know. And I thought, oh, that's steady, that's fantastic. You know, that is so satisfying that the universe is in steady state. And then I thought, you know, but that's just like religion. You know, you'll never, ever be able to prove steady state or Big Bang. It's obviously a kind of anthropomorphic decision that you're going to make, whether you like this or you don't like it. You know, there was something satisfying about the steady state, something primitive about the Big Bang, but then it depends on your personality. That's kind of my thinking at that age. And I think what blew my mind later in life was to learn in my early 20s, well, I think I still may have been a graduate student, actually. Yes, I was a graduate student. That you could distinguish the two, and that an experiment had been done, even though the people that did it had not the faintest idea that's what they were doing, which was also an interesting lesson for me, and they got the Nobel Prize for it, even though they didn't know what they were doing. That was a later lesson. But that they had actually discovered that it was the Big Bang, that you could distinguish it, and that what they observed, amazingly, was in agreement with a mathematical calculation.
This was Penzias
and Wilson.
Wilson.
And I thought that was so compelling. And that really convinced me that mathematics is kind of the language of the universe, and that Latin or Hebrew or Sanskrit weren't, and that, you know, this is what, you know, I should devote my life to. Although I must admit, it took me a very long time to get passionate about it, because I was interested in many other things. And I have a kind of bizarre spiritual side to my personality, and it didn't, and it was difficult dealing with hard science with that. And to be honest with you, my passion didn't really, I didn't get passionate in the sense that, you know, I don't know, evangelical almost, that I mean, until I was quite mature as a scientist. You know, I think unification, the learning, you know, the ideas about unified theories, I thought were extraordinary. And that began that process.
Now, when you say bizarre, mystical, I mean, often one finds that physicists, in fact, do have this rather more Spinozistic sense of the unity of all being.
Yes.
And which is...
So that was it. So, okay, very
quasi-Zen-like.
Yes. So it's interesting. Yes. And that's why when unification came about, you know, and the standard model of elementary particles developed in the end of the 20th century, in the, you know, beginning in, well, really the 80s and 90s. That was so extraordinary because it did have this, by, you know, this unity to it, this fact that, you know, all of this comes from this. It's kind of extraordinary. And there's it somehow resonated with some internal spirituality, I'll call it that. Even though that spirituality for me is expressed through a bunch of equations and a bunch of extraordinary experiments that were done. And that has only increased in the years that I have migrated into the biology and now into this social organization, City Stuff, where I've seen an even greater kind of unity, if you like, unification, and yet it's a bizarre unification because, you know, if you go back to the high energy physics elementary particle viewpoint, the end point of that now is string theory. That's the fundamental entities of nature are strings, and that you know, everything is derived from them in some way. And therefore, you have this completely weird name, theory of everything, that people use, which I began to appreciate was a complete misnomer, because it's a theory of something, and maybe even the evolution of the universe, for all we know. But one of the things that I learned getting involved in biology, which I find fascinating, is that somehow, at some level, the evolution of the universe is simple and life is complex. Now, everybody sort of knows this, but it hit me very hard. Yet, there is nevertheless an extraordinary unity to life, is what I believe, is the work that I've been involved in. And now, an even greater unity that comes from trying to incorporate in that the social nature of man, mm-hmm. as distinct from biology, and seeing that as part of that unity, and that actually, certainly in terms of the way of thinking, and certainly in terms of the kinds of mathematics and the paradigm that is being used, that there is actually a unity with the kind of unity that resonates with me from unified theories in physics. Now, I'm not sure I'm being coherent in saying this. Nevertheless, what I've expressed in the last 10 minutes is to some extent from the head and to some extent, so to speak, from the heart and the guts. And that's why I use the word passion, because it's an emotion. And there's an emotional, what I've recognized, to my surprise, there's almost an emotional dimension to this. And I can tell you that I felt this first when I did the work on trees, and most importantly, extended it to forests. And the paper that you refer to that came out this past year in Nature, in PNAS, the work was actually done, the basis of that work was done many years ago. It just needed a lot of other stuff and a lot of data gathering and so on. It took a long time to put the paper together. But the thing I learned from that work was that when, you know, you go for a walk in the forest and it looks like big trees and small trees and little, you know, just like this great big mess, this random mess. And what this work said, it ain't a random mess. There is extraordinary structure. There, it is so systematized, this forest, even though you don't see it. And it's obeying rules. And these rules are conforming to some principles that are playing out a mathematical, being played out in a mathematical framework. And this forest is actually, this is what blew my mind, a representation of an individual tree. It behaves as if it were an individual tree. And I'd walk through a forest, one's out here actually, and I would be kind of like, it would almost be a mystical spiritual experience feeling it. Now, maybe that was arrogance, you know, the fact that I felt I understood it, but I don't think so. I don't think it was ego. I think it was actually this kind of weird feeling, a kind of religious feeling of being at one with the universe, that somehow what's going on here in some extraordinary way is related to the Big Bang as well. Now, I can't, that's why I say this is, I'm not sure I can articulate that in a logical way. And, you know, a physicist listening to me may think I've gone out of my mind. You know, I'm getting into my dotage. But I do feel that in a kind of an emotional dimension in my life. And it plays an important role in the way I do science. And if I didn't feel that, I'd probably go and, you know, gradually retire. That's what drives me, because I find this so exciting. And why, beginning next Friday, I'm no longer president of the Santa Fe Institute.